What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. Today, we're going to do something of a fiber masterclass, a fiber 101. But 101 implies we're just going to do the absolute basics. We're probably going to do a little bit more than that. But as always, I want to try and balance this and not have it be a 15-minute discussion where I just tell you fiber is good for you and you should eat more of it and here are some foods. And also not a two-hour discussion where we, you know, break down and go down every single rabbit hole possible. Let's do something in the middle, right? We'll keep it simple, keep it practical, go down some rabbit holes, some of the cool stuff, and hopefully we have a nice mix. And so here's what we're going to talk about. What is fiber and what happens to it in the body? Soluble versus insoluble and who cares? Health benefits of fiber. Some statistics. How important is fiber diversity? Daily requirements and recommendations. Why is it so hard for people to hit fiber targets and some strategies to make it easier? Top high fiber foods you should eat more of. And then an FAQ kind of riff sesh. I took some questions from Instagram and felt like, you know, after we do a bit more of like a formal step-by-step table of contents sort of thing, we could do a bit of a rapid fire of some of your FAQs at the end here. So let's start with what is fiber and what happens to it in the body? So just straight definition, fiber is or refers to non-digestible parts of plant foods that make it to our large intestine, our colon, to be fermented by bacteria, right? So some fibers end up being fermented by bacteria, some others don't. And they do a whole bunch of cool stuff too that we'll go through later. Essentially, you have bacteria in your gut, and dietary fiber is more or less the only thing that survives digestion long enough to reach the bacteria in your colon to feed them, which is where the vast majority of your gut bacteria live, is in your large intestine and your colon. And again, dietary fiber is, again, more or less the only thing that actually makes it all the way there, is resists digestion to the point at which it can get into your large intestine and some of it be fermented by certain gut bacteria. And when I say feed your gut bacteria, what I mean is, again, fermented by. So this fermentation process produces what are called short-chain fatty acids. You'll see the acronym SCFAs, like butyrate, acetate, and propionate, right? And these different short-chain fatty acids do different things. You know, oversimplification might be, you know, butyrate's really good for your colon, propionate helps lower cholesterol, and acetate can actually be used as an energy source. And so you don't necessarily need to know that. You just need to know that they do good stuff, that they're good for you. And so the TLDR is that you eat fiber. It doesn't get broken down until the colon. Some of it doesn't get broken down at all. It feeds your gut bugs and good things happen, right? And you'll see words like prebiotic versus probiotic. And the word prebiotic, it means food for your bacteria. And probiotic is actual bacteria. So if you have a product that has a probiotic in it, or you're taking a probiotic, you're actually like helping populate your gut with more bacteria. A prebiotic is ultimately something that you hope feeds the gut bacteria you already have, right? So probiotics are like planting new flowers in your garden. And prebiotics are like watering or fertilizing the plants and flowers you already have, right? You need both, right? You need seeds and you need soil. You need the flowers and you need the water. And so the prebiotic is the food for your current gut bacteria, and the probiotics are essentially adding bacteria to your gut. We'll talk a little bit about soluble versus insoluble. I will say before I even start that, like you don't really need to be thinking about this a whole lot unless you have a very specific kind of ailment or you'll hear, we'll talk about, you know, why I feel that way in a second, but I think it is something we should cover. So soluble just means it dissolves in water. And when it does that, it forms a gel-like substance. The soluble fibers are fermentable by your gut bacteria and they produce the short chain fatty acids that we just went over. Sources of, you know, soluble fiber are oats, barley, beans, lentils, apples, citrus fruits, carrots, psyllium, and flax. I will say as we're doing this, like, plant foods give you a mix of soluble and insoluble. It's not like the list of foods I just gave you only have soluble fiber. That's not true. Every plant is going to have a mix of soluble and insoluble. And it's not even, you know, most plants don't even have a very skewed mix. It's not like those foods are like 95% soluble. It is, in the true sense of the word, a fairly even mix quite often. But yes, these are sources that are a bit higher in soluble fiber. The key benefits of soluble fiber are lowering LDL cholesterol, slowing glucose absorption, so it basically helps control your blood sugar. improves satiety, and ultimately is what feeds the microbiome. Insoluble fiber does not dissolve in water, and so the insoluble fibers are staying more intact as they pass through digestion. They are less fermentable. Some parts can be fermented, and so you can think of soluble as the part that ultimately feeds your gut, and you can think of insoluble as the some of the stuff that survives through entirely digestion. You end up kind of pooping it out. Some sources that are high in insoluble fiber, bran, nuts, seeds, the skins of fruits and vegetables, celery, cauliflower. Key benefits are adding bulk to stool, right? So these are not dissolving in water and they stay more intact. They're not forming a gel-like substance like the soluble fibers. It speeds up intestinal transit. So kind of the opposite of what the soluble fiber does, which kind of slows down digestion. And this, you can imagine, helps prevent things like constipation, hemorrhoids, diverticulosis, etc. You can think of soluble fiber as like oatmeal. It's just like this thick, it slows down digestion, feeds your gut bugs. And insoluble fiber is a little bit more like a broom, right? That's like sweeping things along and keeping, your plumbing in check. Both of them are important. And, when people talk about fiber, they think, oh, it lowers cholesterol. It makes me feel more full. It helps me poop. It's like, yeah, it's doing all those things. But technically, the insoluble is doing some of it. The soluble is doing some of it. But ultimately, not only do you need both, but plant foods give you both. And so you don't necessarily need to be thinking about this a whole lot. Again, unless you are, like, let's say you have a very specific goal of lowering your LDL cholesterol, you might specifically seek out foods that are high in soluble fiber. If you are dealing with constipation, you might seek out foods that are higher in insoluble fiber. But ultimately, most people in most cases just trying to eat more fiber to be healthy don't really need to be thinking about soluble versus insoluble. Need to be thinking more about eating enough total fiber and getting that fiber from a diverse source, which we will talk about in a second. And we've touched on the health benefits, but just to give it its own section, the health benefits, the first one is gut health. And I will admit, just typing that out, sometimes that's a bit vague. You might think if you're in our little social media sphere that we know a whole heck a lot about the gut. We don't. If you listen to real gut health experts, they will speak with quite a humble understanding of the gut, and they are the people actually doing the research. And then you go to somebody selling some sort of detox who's talking about the gut as if that they have it all figured out. But it is well understood that fiber is having a positive effect on the gut. It has those prebiotic effects, right? The microbiome fermentation, the production of short chain fatty acids, which we know are doing good things. But again, we're still learning about all the benefits of short chain fatty acids. But for now, we can just assume that they're having positive effects in different parts of the body. Number two is blood sugar regulation. It helps slow gastric emptying, and that terminology people are quite familiar with because GLP-1s also slow gastric emptying and by extension provide some sort of glycemic control and help you control your blood sugar. Number three is they lower cholesterol. Again, particularly the soluble fiber, things like oats, barley, psyllium, apples, citrus fruits, beans, and lentils. And more, obviously, it's not an exhaustive list. They improve satiety and weight management, and overall, they improve longevity and help you fight chronic disease, right? Lower chronic disease risk. Let's go through some statistics around fiber that I think are just meaningful enough to internalize. The Lancet in 2019 showed that a high fiber intake between 25 to 29 grams per day versus a group getting less than 15 grams per day saw a 16 to 24% lower incidence of colorectal cancer. We have a super massive pooled analysis, over 185 studies, 135 million person year follow-ups, found that for every 8 gram per day increase in dietary fiber was associated with, somewhere between a 5 and 27% risk of all cause and cause specific mortality, things like cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and colon cancer. Overall, the study showed an inverse correlation between fiber intake and death by any cause, right? The more fiber you ate, the less people died. And that's also what we saw in a paper that, has been quoted so many times, which is the Yang paper from 2014, that saw that for every 10 gram of fiber increase, we saw a 10% reduction in all-cause mortality. Again, the more fiber that people ate, the less they died from any cause. And it didn't even seem like there was this massive upper limit where, if you eat that much fiber, it starts to be bad for you. We did not see that, really. It just kept getting better. And then in the BMJ 2011, we saw every 10 gram of fiber increase is also associated with 10% reduction in colorectal cancer risk, which again, kind of just, again, another notch on the belt of more fiber, die less. Let's talk about diversity. I think diversity is something that we're going to begin to talk about more, just because I think the first step is for people to eat more fiber, get their fiber numbers up. The second thing, maybe not necessarily in chronological order, but before now, I think encouraging people to eat more fiber is almost easier. And then beginning a journey on diversity to change up kind of where you're getting your fiber is the next step, because diversity is important. So let's talk about how important it is. Well, or let's even back up, like, why would fiber diversity or the foods that you're eating being diverse, why would that be important? Well, different microbes in your body specialize in breaking down different types of fibers. We have studies showing that eating a wide variety of plants, I don't know, maybe you guys have heard of this 30 plants per week rule from the American Gut Project, is associated with a more diverse, more resilient microbiome. And if you hear me say that and you think, oh, that's kind of vague, like, I hear you. Ultimately, you have a lot of different types of bacteria in your colon, in your large intestine, in your body, and they thrive, or they, let's say, prefer different types of food, right? They prefer different types of fiber. And, you know, one of the only things I think gut health experts can really agree upon is that gut bug or bacterial diversity is almost certainly a good thing. So you have more diversity in microbes. You know, we hypothesize this is leading to better immune function, less inflammation, more robust short-chain fatty acid production. An example of this would be resistant starch, which we'll talk about in a bit later. We had plenty of questions on resistant starch. Things like cooled potatoes, beans, oats end up through the fermentation process producing more butyrate, right, which is good for colon cells. And then we have things like beta-glucans, or like oatmeal and barley, end up producing a more propionate, which really help regulate cholesterol. And together, right, by having more diverse intake, they create a broader spectrum of benefits than any of them alone, right? And so it's not like every single type of fiber gives you all of the benefits. So diversifying the types of foods, and by extension, the type of fiber you're eating, is going to give you a broader spectrum of benefits. I think that that's something that makes enough common sense, logical sense, that it isn't something that's we need to necessarily dive too deep on. I would add that aiming for more diverse fiber types also mean, right? Aiming for more diverse fiber types. What does that mean? That means eating a larger diversity of different plant foods also means you're probably getting more diverse micronutrient intake, right? When you decide, hey, I'm going to diversify my plant intake, that means you're getting a whole bunch of different colors and different fruits and vegetables and textures, all of which are bringing with them different nutritional profiles, which is also really good. So it's not just about the diverse fiber types. It's also the fact that a knock-on effect of diversifying your plant intake will be, you know, diversifying your micronutrient intake, which is also super important. So let's talk about daily requirements and maybe a bit of a reality check here. I was asked on my Instagram stories this past week about a daily requirement, or more of like how much fiber is best. And if you stop me on the street and you say, you know, you stop me, you grab me, you say, how much fiber is best? My answer before continuing to walk is as much as your GI can handle. And we'll get into kind of a bit of the nuance of that in just a second. But right now the RDA is 25 grams for women and 38 grams for men. And right now, on average, on a population standpoint, we're getting about 15 grams of fiber per day in the US. So kind of far below the recommendations. Another recommendation that you'll see is somewhere between 10 and 15 grams per 1,000 calories, which makes sense if you think, let's not generalize in terms of calories, but if you go back to that RDA, you could say, okay, women are eating, let's say the average woman maintenance calories, you could kind of extrapolate and do the math how we get from 10 to 15 grams per 1,000 calories to those kind of RDA recommendations for men and women. And again, it's not necessarily a sex thing. This is more of a body size thing. And men being on average larger, on average eating more, on average need more fiber, not necessarily a woman thing. But I will say we're going to get to this discussion on your kind of gastrointestinal symptoms. If people feel like they get farty or gassy or bloaty or GI discomfort, we'll get there. But truthfully, the answer is the more the merrier. The most fiber you can handle, the better. And that doesn't mean you should push yourself through immense discomfort. And I'll talk a little bit about how to increase your fiber, I'm sure, at some point in the next 18 sections. But we're getting through this actually pretty quick here. I'm impressed. It's because I made some notes that I'm staying on track here. So moving on. Why is it so hard for most people? We have a couple, I'm working in a couple of Q&As here, actually. Why is it so hard for most people to hit fiber targets, and what are some strategies to make it easier? I thought about this one for a bit. Obviously, I work with clients, and one of the things that we focus on a lot is increasing fiber intake, right? We track it. And so that's number one, is to actually track it, right? If we're talking about strategies to make it easier, measure it. People get kind of weird when we talk about tracking, but there is an element of what gets measured gets managed. That doesn't mean you need to measure something forever, but bringing awareness to how much fiber you are or are not eating is, you know, quite possibly your first step to improving it. I also think we're still behind on average in terms of understanding how important fiber actually is. I think right now protein is the darling of the health conscious space, let's say, right? In the health and wellness space, protein is everything. Protein is all the rage. But I think fiber is, and I'll riff on this a little bit at the end, but I think fiber is more important. But if you hear me say that fiber is more important than protein when it comes to where you should be focused on, if you hear me say that and that seems like, oh my God, that's news to me, I believe you. I bet that would be news to most people. So I think that there's also an element of people just not understanding how beneficial fiber can be. And let's be real, that's because when you talk about how beneficial protein is, we get to talk about how muscular it makes and how much it boosts your metabolism and it makes you look better. And that's way sexier than, hey, this is going to reduce your cholesterol and help you poop more and help you produce these short chain fatty acids that, like, they do good stuff, but not, you know, they don't make you look better, let's say, right? So it's a little bit less sexy from a marketing perspective. Also, you know, over 50% of the American diet comes from ultra processed foods. And one of the key characteristics of ultra processed foods on average, not every single ultra processed food, but on average, they are going to be, you know, lower in fiber, which is one of the reasons that they are very easy to overconsume. And then flat out, obviously, we just don't eat enough fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds. Like, we just don't eat enough plants. So why is it so hard for people to hit targets? Because we don't eat enough foods that are high in fiber. And I'll go through some high fiber foods in the next section. So when we're talking about how to make it easier, strategies to get more fiber into your diet, the first one, like we talked about, is tracking it. Another one that I like is, okay, once you track it, you might be aiming for, let's say, 10 to 15 grams per 1,000 calories. You've set yourself a goal for 30 grams or whatever, is to take that daily target and break it up into per meal targets, right? It's nice to just aim for, and I have a, if you've listened to the podcast before, you know I'm a big fan of at least considering using per meal targets. It's really nice to have a daily step goal, a daily protein goal, a daily calorie goal, and to tell yourself it doesn't matter how I split that up across the day. All that matters is when my head hits the pillow that I hit those daily targets. That's really nice. But sometimes that's almost too much freedom. It's like too much wiggle room. Sometimes it's nice to have a per meal target where you're like, well, instead of focusing on 30 grams per day, I'm going to focus on having 10 grams of fiber at each meal 3 times a day. That might actually be a more tangible, smaller, achievable goal that you can be really consistent with. And you know that if you do that, you will meet your larger daily goal. And again, over time, larger goals. So I'm a big fan of taking that daily goal and breaking it up into per meal targets without getting neurotic with it, right? Like, we're just like, every time I talk about making rules, sorts of like having a protocol, just stay flexible with it. But of course, if you're aiming to increase your fiber, it's good to think about this on a per day scale for sure, but it's also good to kind of zoom in on a per meal basis and say, I'm going to do the things I need to do to actually get to that daily goal. It's the same thing with steps. If you're trying to get 10,000 steps per day, you probably want to say, well, I want to get some of those in the morning, maybe some of those at midday, and then maybe some of those in the evening, right? You don't want to just be like, oh, I'll wait till later. I'll get them later. It might be helpful to break them up intentionally. And then obviously the next one would be identifying high fiber foods and intentionally including more of them. Duh. Sprinkle little add-ins, right? Like, if you're already having things like oatmeal or yogurt or smoothies, add in some chia seeds or flax seeds or basil seeds. You won't even know they're there. You know, if you want to add in ground chia, ground flax seeds, this totally fine. Doesn't mess with the fiber content at all. In fact, there are actually some benefits to grinding certain seeds. Additionally, while we're just having this chat about preparation around things like chia seed, flaxseed, chia seeds and things like basil seeds, you might want to soak them a bit before. It can actually aid in just, it can actually just boost the benefits that you're getting from them. It also makes them just a more enjoyable texture to eat. One of my favorite kind of, I say recipe, but me saying recipe for what I'm about to explain sums me up in a nutshell from a cooking perspective. But a recipe I really like is taking a yogurt drink. It doesn't need to be a specific brand, a Chobani, a Oikos, whatever. And then pouring that out into a bowl and then adding 30 grams or whatever, doesn't need to be 30 grams, of chia seeds, mixing it up and letting it sit overnight. Because the yogurt drink is a little liquidy and the chia seeds, you know, form that sort of gel-like substance around them. When you mix it up, it's actually a really nice texture. I have found for me personally, if I take regular yogurt, which is much thicker, and then I put chia seeds in it, and then I put it in the fridge, in the morning, it's like, for me, it's like cement. I don't mind it so much in oatmeal. I find that the texture ends up being quite nice in oatmeal as well. But if you like these things ground, milled, whatever, all good. And then the last strategy would be to supplement with something like psyllium husk. Psyllium husk is primarily a soluble fiber, helps lower cholesterol, helps slow digestion time, helps with satiety. Just be careful about having like a whole massive serving of psyllium husk at once. It could be quite thick. But you know, psyllium husk, do I want to name brands? Whatever. Like Metamucil is a brand that I'm sure people are familiar with. Metamucil is psyllium husk. So it's just, if that's a word you'd never heard of, but you've heard of Metamucil, that's what it is. So let's go through top high fiber foods, you know, to add to your diet today. And while I'm going to list some, as I started making this list, I was like, dude, it's just, you need to eat more fruits, more vegetables, more legumes, more whole grains, more nuts, and more seeds, and you'll get enough fiber. I'm not saying that a good strategy isn't to identify high fiber foods and add them. That is a good strategy, but it's more about a habitual diet makeover. Like, you know, if you're a person who eats a large portion of minimally processed plant foods at each meal, your diet revolves around plant foods as it should, then you probably don't need to be thinking very specifically about the amount of fiber in each food. But if you are somebody for whom let's say you're not doing that right now and you want to be more intentional with this very specific addition of foods, I respect that. I do a lot of that work with clients. But I do think there's a broader discussion here of like, you know, I would want to move people along the spectrum to the point where their diet is based around these foods and not necessarily needing to hyper-focus about, you know, a very specific addition of high fiber foods. Anyway, we're going to talk about, I'll list off how much fiber some of these foods have, and I will be talking about it in the context of per 100 calories. So just because a food has more grams of fiber, that might not mean that they're more dense with fiber, right, per calorie. So these are all fiber numbers or grams of fiber per 100 calories. The first one is shirataki noodles. If you're unfamiliar with shirataki noodles, get familiar. They're, you know, as a noodle connoisseur, I tend to stay away from really low calorie noodle options unless I'm in a weight loss phase. I just love pasta so much. But, you know, listen, shirataki noodles have been in my house many, many times. I've cooked them many, many times. And if you're somebody out there who, you know, isn't necessarily a pasta nut and is looking for a low, very, very low calorie, very high fiber option, shirataki noodles have 10 to 12 grams of fiber per 100 calories, which is nuts. Basil seeds, also 12 grams of fiber per 100 calories. Broccoli rabe, 9 to 10 grams of fiber. Raspberries, blackberries, in that like 8 to 10 grams of fiber. That, by the way, guys, that's a lot of fiber. If your daily fiber goal is like 30, you could have 100 calories of raspberries at a meal, and that's all your fiber for that meal that you need, right? Lentils, 8 grams of fiber. Split peas, 8 grams of fiber. You're going to hear me wax lyrical about lentils and peas and beans later. Chia seeds, 7 grams. Black beans, 6 to 7 grams. Whole grain bread, 4 to 5 grams. Avocado, 5 to 6 grams. Currently in my life, my go-tos are frozen mixed berries, and I like the mixed option because we talked about diversity. and berries are incredible for you. Buying, you know, if one easy way to increase diversity is to buy mixes. Can you make, you know, I've been making a 3-bean salad, let's say. And what that does for me is allows me to make one thing, which is this mix of beans that is already a diverse source of fiber because it's a couple of foods mixed together. And so getting something like mixed berries or mixed fruit is a really great way to bake in some variety with no extra kind of labor. So my go-tos are frozen mixed berries, chia in the yogurt drink, like we talked about, chia seeds in yogurt or oatmeal, apples, avocados, beans and lentils, oatmeal. And I know I just said I don't really like those super low calorie pastas, but when I say bean pastas, something like, you know, what is the chickpea pasta? The chickpea pasta brand is escaping me. Bonza. Bonza's pretty good. Bonza's pretty good. But if you have never checked out Kaizen, K-A-I-Z-E-N, not sponsored, by the way, they did send me a box of goodies. They're, the macros, you will not believe it. It's a pasta. They make rice also. It's from lupini beans. You know what? I'm sitting at my computer. I'm going to pull up the macros. It's just absolutely insane. Of course, their macros are factoring in some net carbs. So I'm not even going to read off necessarily the calories, but you get 15 grams of fiber and 20 grams of protein per serving. 15 grams of fiber and 20 grams of protein per serving. It is insane. So if I'm behind on fiber for the day or just trying to have a higher fiber option at dinner, it's almost like a food that gets you, it's a food that gets me my two main things that I'm looking for in a single food, right? Like when I'm thinking about building a meal, I want a high fiber food and I want a high protein food. And this is both of those. And so it's such a good base of a meal. Sometimes, you know, I'll have this maybe with some fruit or something. I know I don't need more fiber, but I do want some more micronutrients with some sauce and cheese. And I'm like, it's like, dude, I have 35 grams of fiber or 40 grams of fiber if I'm having two servings and 40 grams of protein, 30 grams of fiber, a little sauce, a little cheese. It's like by itself, this fantastic, fantastic meal, basically no saturated fat, just fantastic. Cool. So let's move on to our FAQ slash riff sesh where I'm kind of just going to go off the cuff. Didn't really make any notes on this. I'm going to read through some of the FAQ just for those of you who are considering sticking around here. We're going to talk about fiber. Are fiber supplements just as good? What about foods that have been that have been jacked up with a lot of fiber? What's the deal with resistant starch? If I'm gassy, is that bad? How come I feel better when I eat less fiber? Is fiber essential? And then I'll riff on kind of fiber versus protein obsession that I kind of teased earlier. So let's cover those in chronological order. Are fiber supplements just as good? You know, just as good as what? Is a fiber supplement just as good as getting your fiber from a single food? Yeah, I mean, let's take what we talked about, Metamucil before. And by the way, Metamucil is not the only brand. I don't want to kind of just plug one single brand here, but Metamucil is psyllium, right? It's psyllium. And psyllium is great. Has some research behind it. That's why it's a super successful brand and super successful kind of supplement. So it's awesome because all types of fiber are good, but getting a fiber supplement tends to suffer from the downside of being low in diversity, right? So if you're like, hey, I get all my fiber from supplements. Well, what you're saying is you're getting all of your fiber from one source. And so you might be getting enough fiber, but you'd be suffering from not getting a diverse type of fiber or diverse types of fiber. And again, total quantity of fiber is important, but different fibers do different things. And if you're looking to extract all the benefits from fiber, you're going to want to get the fiber from different sources. What about foods that have been jacked up with a lot of fiber? I'm at my computer again. There's one of these bagel brands my friend asked me about. It's called Sola Bagels. I guess Sola is like South LA. And maybe that's just me assuming that because they're like incredibly expensive and that must be something from LA. I'm going to read you off the macros from here. They sell bagels. The bagels have 29 grams of fiber, right? And they do that, by the way. I'm not going to go into net carbs right now, but they do that so that they, like one bagel, it says one bagel is 110 calories. They are allowed to list 110 calories because what they've done is they've subtracted all the dietary fiber from the carbohydrates, and they don't count those calories because, as we talked about, maybe I can talk a little bit about diet, about net carbs, but because, like we talked about, you don't fully digest and extract all of the calories from fiber. That's the point. And there's really loose regulations on nutrition labels. They can take off all of the calories from fiber. So this bagel has 36 grams of carbs, but 29 grams of fiber. So you take 36, you minus 29. And basically this bagel only has 7 grams of fiber. Or sorry, 7 grams of carbohydrates. And only, you know, 7 grams of carbohydrates are going into the total calories. And that's not necessarily how it works. We do extract some calories from different types of fibers. So that's not technically true. But I think a lot of people are think that that's not true at all. They think that this is a complete lie, that net carbs are a complete lie. It's not a complete lie. It's just not wholly true. And so they're not being 100% truthful, but they're also not 100% lying when they take off all the calories. Anyway, that wasn't necessarily the question. What do I think about those foods? They suffer from a similar issue as the fiber supplements. You know, these bagels, if I can find it very quickly, where's the ingredient list here? Most of the fiber is probably coming from a single source, whether that's, you know, a modified wheat starch. Modified wheat starch, right? So it has a lot of fiber, but most or all of that fiber comes from a single source. If you look at like those Mission carb wraps, I think they are almost entirely pumped with cellulose, and cellulose basically isn't digested at all. And so they take all of the fiber off of the carbohydrates and off of the calories, which is actually largely accurate because we don't extract a lot of calories from cellulose. I digress. That's fine, by the way. Those foods are fine, but you're getting a lot of fiber from a single source. And so you're hitting your fiber targets, and I'm happy with that. I'm speaking to you guys like you're a client. I'm happy you're hitting your fiber targets, but we are not getting all of the benefits from fiber if we're getting all of our fiber from a single source. So I don't mind these foods being in your diet, listener. But if you're finding that you're getting 30 grams of fiber per day from 4 Mission wraps, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing for your body. What I mean is you're not getting all of the benefits from fiber that you could be getting. Now, what is the deal with resistant starch? You know, and so you'll see things out there like cooking and cooling rice decreases the calorie intake by X. And what those posts are saying is that because when you cook starches and then you cool them, what happens is some of the starch undergoes what's called retrogradation. It like recrystallizes into a form that digestive enzymes can't break down. So some of the starches, I'll just say it simply, some of the starches, when you cool and cook starch or starchy foods, some of the starches become resistant to digestion. And that's why it's called resistant starch. And so some of those starches become resistant to digestion, and they make it to the large intestine, and it behaves a lot like dietary fiber. So I said before that dietary fiber is basically the only thing that makes it to the colon. That's not true. Resistant starch also does. And because we don't digest or we don't absorb, let's say we don't absorb any calories from resistant starch. That's not really true, but let's say it that way. That means that we would be decreasing the calorie content of that food because some of the parts of that food now are not able to be digested and metabolized. So those posts are mostly BS. They are extrapolating on a partial truth where if you increase the resistant starch content of a food, then obviously you are decreasing the percentage of that food that we can actually extract calories from. Here's the deal. It's not a big deal. Resistant starch is fascinating, by the way, and it's really good for you, just like dietary fiber. So I just want to make that clear. Resistant starch is awesome. And I want to come back to how much of an increase in resistant starch we see when we cook and then cool certain starches, but I just want to go back and take this from the top. So most of the starches in foods, potatoes, rice, pasta, gets broken down into glucose pretty rapidly, depending on the kind of meal composition. But a fraction of that starch resists digestion in the small intestine and instead makes it to the large intestine where it ferments, again, behaving a lot like dietary fiber. which again has very similar benefits, improves blood sugar, supports the gut, increases satiety, maybe improves insulin sensitivity. You know, parts of those foods undergo retrogradation, which is this kind of recrystallization into a form that your digestive enzymes cannot easily break it down, right? Now, this sounds super cool. You'll see things like when you cook and cool rice that you increase the resistant starch content by 600% or something, right? Yeah, that's true. But you know, it's I chuckle because if you just cook rice, which I love rice, my rice cooker is like the only appliance that has not just made it into the appliance graveyard in our pantry. It's something I use every week, multiple times a week. If you make rice freshly cooked, white rice, it has like 0.5 grams of resistant starch. So very, very little resistant starch. And if you cook white rice and you cool it overnight, and then the next day you heat it up again, it has like at most 3 grams of resistant starch. Again, to put that in perspective, you know, 100 calories of basil seeds has like 12 grams of fiber, right? And so this is like 3 grams of fiber, 3 grams of resistant starch. So, you know, it's not really a big deal. People, you know, think that this is a huge deal. It's not. Now, it's not a huge deal, but it doesn't also cost you anything. So I do this every week. I make a large batch of rice or potatoes, and then I meal prep and it goes in the fridge. And so that's like a pretty normal practice. So while this kind of cooking and cooling starches situation isn't a game breaker, it's not changing the game, it's also not outside of normal practice. And it's a benefit that you can get quite easily. Just cook a bunch of rice and then put it in, you know, eat some of it and put the rest in the fridge. And then every time you take it out and reheat it, you're going to be getting more resistant starch. And so that's a good thing with, again, a pretty low cost. I'm going to take a long time on these questions. Okay, let's talk about this one. If I'm gassy, is that bad? I work with clients every day who, when they increase their fiber, they might feel some discomfort, right? Some mild gas, some bloating, maybe, you know, just some GI discomfort generally. I would say that tentatively, that's not bad. And that's not a sign that you're doing something wrong. It's not a sign that that's too much fiber for you. It's just more fiber than you normally have. And there will be an adjustment period when you increase your fiber. And so it's not necessarily too much if you have a little gas, if you have a little bloating. Bloating is a hot topic because, you know, again, it's just kind of this triggering thing of like, oh, I'm larger, I'm fat now. It's like, if you have a little gas, if you have a little bloating, it's normal, especially when you're adjusting to higher fiber. It's not necessarily too much. I would either, you know, again, if it's getting to be excessively, you know, uncomfortable, sure, maybe you can lower fiber, but this, the better take home from this is if you're listening and you're thinking about increasing your fiber, do it incrementally, you know, go slowly, maybe add 3 to 5 grams, you know, every few days instead of kind of doubling your intake overnight. But yeah, if you have excessive discomfort, you have pain, you have diarrhea, you know, again, even that doesn't mean that's too much fiber for you. It just might mean that that's too much fiber for you right now, and maybe you overshot what your tolerance is for now. If you're experiencing chronic issues, yeah, I think it can point to things like IBS, you know, FODMAP sensitivity, poor gut adaptations to the fiber amount, you know. It's tricky. I think GI discomfort is a tricky one because if someone's like, hey, I'm having a little GI discomfort and I just increased my fiber, I would say, yeah, totally normal. Like stick with it, you know, drink more water, mix in fiber type. You know, it's possible that you loaded up on a single fiber type and that's having some sort of enhanced or enlarged reaction, right? Try and increase your diversity. Again, hydrate really well, cook your foods, right? Cook your beans and your veggies, reheat those starchy foods. It can reduce some of that kind of fermentable load and just make it a little bit easier from a digestion perspective. And then also look at your fiber per meal, right? Maybe you're aiming for 30 grams of fiber per day and you're getting 25 of that in a single meal. It's like, okay, like, yeah, okay, that's a lot at one meal. Maybe you want to split that up across more meals. I said the word FODMAPs before, and I just think we can double click on that. FODMAP is an acronym, stands for fermentable oligo dimonosaccharides and polyols. And you can Google just high FODMAP foods. I'm not going to go through them all right now. You can Google a list, but Long story short, some people don't tolerate these foods well. If I have a client come to me experiencing a high amount of GI discomfort, a lot, like they are expressing that it's a very uncomfortable amount of gas and bloating and pain, one of the first things we'll try is reducing FODMAPs and just seeing if those foods in particular, because of how fermentable they are, because of how much gas is kind of created as a byproduct of this fermentation process, that it's causing some level of discomfort. Which brings me to the next question, which is how come I feel better when I eat less fiber? And it's true. Some people will have, you know, some sort of a reaction to certain types of fiber, specifically the ones at the top of the list tend to be FODMAPs. And when you eat less, or, you know, I'll use this as an opportunity to talk about carnivore people, or you eat no fiber, like people on a carnivore diet, you won't have that reaction anymore, right? Like if certain foods, types of fiber, maybe FODMAPs were leading to some GI discomfort, if you just eat no fiber, you won't have that reaction anymore. The problem is you're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. If you go into, which I don't recommend you do unless you're looking to have your brain just melt into oatmeal, go into like carnivore Facebook groups where people are talking about their anecdote, the positive ones will sound like, I stopped eating fiber and my GI discomfort went away, or my autoimmune disorder, you know, symptoms went down, which by the way, I'm happy for people when that happens, but they are almost certainly throwing the baby out with the bathwater. They are getting rid of all fiber. And even if a small portion of the fiber types they were eating were the problematic ones, they've now gotten rid of all fiber types. And, you know, the correct thing to do might be something like an elimination diet, but then systematic reintroduction of fiber, because fiber is important. Fiber is healthy. You know, it's going to help you live longer and fight disease. So you probably want to explore the fibers that you can, the fiber types, the foods that you can tolerate well, instead of just eliminating fiber altogether. Somebody wrote in that, hey, fiber is not essential. I hear that a lot. Could you speak to that? I always think of the Matthew McConaughey, you know, be a lot cooler if you did. It's like fiber is not essential, but like you'd live a lot cooler if you did. Like you'd live a lot longer if you did. The word essential in a scientific perspective just means that you will die if you don't get this, right? We have essential nutrients. We have essential body fat. We have essential amino acids. And they're essentially, don't use the word in the definition, nutrients of interest that if you don't have them, you'll die. That's what essential means. You must get them from somewhere. Fiber, yeah, you will not die if you don't eat fiber. And so, yeah, when someone says fiber is not essential, that is technically true. But every piece of research we have points to eating more fiber leading to reduction in risk of basically every disease and dying of every cause. So two things can be true. Fiber is not essential, and you'll live longer if you eat more fiber. Quick riff on this protein versus fiber chat I brought up a bit before. I don't want to overdo it and sound like too radical about this, but eating more fiber is more important than eating more protein. You know, we are so freaking obsessed with protein in our little fitness bubble, but your life will be no different if you eat 0.5 grams of fiber per body, 0.5 grams per pound body weight protein, or 0.8 grams per pound protein. Like, it will make no difference in your health, really. You might see a little bump in muscle growth, but muscle growth, the vast majority of the muscle you build comes down to training stimulus and total calories and getting enough sleep and recovery. Protein actually has a small modifying effect on lifting weight, muscle growth outcomes compared to the other inputs. So yeah, protein's important. You know, I think that that's almost a vague statement. Like, what does that mean? Is it important to eat the absolute maximum amount of protein for health? It's not. If you're a pro bodybuilder looking to absolutely maximize every single gram of muscle that you can possibly build over the lifespan, sure, you should be aiming for a lot of protein. But when it comes to health, we need to flip the script. Like, you know, if I could choose somebody who's eating a gram a pound per protein or 15 grams of fiber per 1,000 calories, I'll take the latter every day of the week for health. You know, you can be healthy and you can extract all of, if not the vast majority of the health benefits of having enough muscle with lower protein than you think if you're eating enough total calories and lifting weights. And so it's not an either or. You should eat enough protein and you should get enough fiber. But if you're obsessed with protein right now because you think it's going to have this crazy, you know, getting a gram per pound of protein is going to have this crazy big effect on your health, and then that's coming at the cost of bandwidth you could be spending on, you know, increasing the amount of fiber you eat, the diversity you're getting, the different types of foods and plant foods you're including in your diet. I think we have that a bit backwards. And again, it's not an either or. I'd like to see people do both. Lift weights, eat enough protein, eat a diverse array of different plant foods, get enough total fiber. I want all of that. So I don't mean to make that into a dichotomy. And just a quick highlight on beans and lentils. I just want to talk about beans and lentils for a second. Beans and lentils, if I say, hey, fitness folk, what do you know about beans and lentils? The first thing out of somebody's mouth is going to be, they're low in protein. They're not a good source of protein. They're not a good... Chill out. Beans and lentils are not as high in protein per calorie as something like egg whites or whey protein or chicken breast or turkey breast. Yeah, that's true. But again, protein's not the only important thing. Let's say for a lot of people, eating enough fiber and enough protein is on your mind, right? Right. You listen to this podcast, you think, okay, fiber is really important. I've been focused on protein for a long time. Now I want to focus on protein and fiber. There isn't a food on earth that's getting you a better bang for your buck, if those are your goals, than beans and lentils. One cup cooked lentils or black beans, it's like 200 calories and change, gets you like 15 grams of protein, 12 to 15 grams of protein, maybe 12 to 18 grams of protein, and like 12 to 15 grams of fiber. So I just want to put that in perspective. If you eat that much chicken breast, 200 grams of chicken breast, you'll get like, I don't know, 40 grams of protein, 45 grams of protein. And that's a lot. No fiber. And so beans and lentils, they might not be the absolute highest protein food that exists. They might not even be the highest fiber food that exists. They're pretty high though, but they are so good at both. And when you start including more beans and lentils, again, all kinds of beans, lentils, other legumes, into your diet, all of a sudden you're hitting protein and fiber, no problem, because they are pretty good at both, right? It's like, it's like a midfielder in soccer who's like pretty good at defense, pretty good at attacking, and pretty good at everything, instead of like a striker who's really good at scoring goals, or a defender who's really good at defending, but, you know, can't score goals. Beans and lentils are really good at two different things, even if they're not elite at any one thing. And the minute I started adding beans and lentils into my diet, my fiber numbers went up, my protein numbers were fine, and all of a sudden it was really easy to hit both of those. If you include, one serving of lentils and beans with a meal that you typically have, all of a sudden the burden you'll feel to hit protein and fiber for that meal will go down. You're like, wow, that's such an incredible kind of box-checking tactic for both of those boxes, that I just think I feel a personal burden that I have slept on beans and lentils for the vast majority of my career in the nutrition space, and they are just criminally underused. Plus, they're super cheap, incredibly easy to produce, prepare, versatile. Many of them, if you get them canned, have an incredibly long shelf life. Even fresh ones have a really long shelf life. Like, if you could do anything from this podcast, it would be increase your intake of legumes, beans, and lentils. Of course, diverse, colorful plant foods, of course, minimally processed plant foods, of course. But beans and lentils, man, if you're a fiber and protein maniac, you want to get both of those in. Beans and lentils are incredible. Even if they're not absolutely elite in either, they are pretty darn good at both, which is very unique. And because I don't even know who's listening after 50 minutes here, but that's why I think people don't eat enough beans and lentils. They don't eat enough beans and lentils because they don't think they are a high fiber food, so they don't add them. They don't think they are they don't think they're a high protein food. They're thinking, okay, I want to get a protein on the plate, so I'm going to have chicken or I'm going to have tofu. And then they also think, okay, for my fiber source, I'm going to have a fruit or vegetable. And so when people are building meals, they think, I want a protein on the plate, I want a fruit or vegetable on the plate, I want a starch on the plate. And they end up forgetting that beans might not neatly fit into one of those categories, but they kind of are all of those categories all at once, right? They are a protein source, they're kind of like a starch source, they're a fiber source. And so it is interesting, if you're trying to draw like a three circle Venn diagram, beans are kind of right in the middle. That was just my shill for big bean and big lentil. If they're, you know, if Goya is listening and you guys want to, you know, Bushes is, if you guys are listening, you know, fire something over. I'd love to chat, talk. All right. Hope you guys learned something. If you have a question about fiber, you want me to clarify or dive deeper on something, as always, you can reach out on Instagram or email. I'll see you guys in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.